Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Kinetic Fitness Show. My name is Ali West. I am your host today, and I welcome each and every one of you to the show. This is episode number 36, and whether you are a brand new listener, this is your first time listening to my show, or whether you are a returning listener, I welcome each and every one of you. Always grateful to have you listening in. And before we get started with today's show and I introduce today's guest, please don't forget to like, subscribe, follow this podcast if you haven't done already. It just takes 2 seconds, click that button, and you'll be updated with all of my latest episodes. Secondly, if you are able to leave a review, don't forget to leave me a review. You can do that via Google, you can do that via iTunes. Just click on the review button and leave me a quick, brief review. Tell me how you're finding the show. Finally, don't forget to follow me on Instagram if you are on there. The handle is Ali West Fitness, Ali West Fitness. You can follow me on Instagram. Take a screenshot of the podcast, share it on your stories, put it in your feed, and I will share it with all of my followers as well. Let's try and spread the love, try and help as many people as we can to get healthier, because that is the mission of this podcast, is to help each and every listener to live a longer, healthier, happier, and more joyful life. That's enough about that. Let's get into today's episode. And today we are going to be discussing intermittent fasting. This is an area that has become extremely popular and extremely talked about in the health and fitness industry. Probably over the last 5 or 6 years, there's been a lot of documentaries, there's been a lot of studies done, lots of fitness professionals and fitness gurus talking about this area of intermittent fasting. And I thought, it's about time we did a podcast about it, got stuck into the nitty-gritty of it, and try and find out what the research says and how beneficial intermittent fasting is for your body and for your overall health. So today I have a very special guest. His name is Ian Templeman. Ian is a PhD student at the University of Bath, and he has spent the last 10 years researching areas in and around metabolic health, and in particularly intermittent fasting. He has recently just completed some fairly extensive studies and research around the area of fasting, and to be honest, I can't wait to get stuck into this episode and pick his brain all around intermittent fasting. He's going to tell you a little bit more about him, a little bit more about his experience and what he's been doing, and then we're going to delve into how beneficial intermittent fasting is for your health, what the best protocol is to follow, whether that's a 24-hour fast or a limited eating time period fasting protocol. We're going to talk about all of that. And then we're going to also talk about what the research and the current studies are showing in terms of the benefits to your overall well-being. So yeah, not going to waste any more time. That's it for the intro of episode number 36. Let's introduce Ian. Let's pick his brain and dive into this area of intermittent fasting. I hope you enjoy this one, guys, and let's get cracking. Episode number 36.
I'm very good, Ali. How are you?
Great, thank you. Yeah, I'm up, ready for action, and ready to dig into this topic that we want to discuss today. Quite a topical subject, I guess, especially in health and well-being and fitness and those realms over the last few years. And I know that you've done extensive research and studies into this area, which is why I wanted to contact you and pick your brain a little bit. But before...
Yeah, I'll do my best to be useful.
Go on, sorry.
I'll do my best to be useful.
Hopefully. Before we get stuck into that, can you just give myself and the guys that will be listening to this podcast a bit of a brief backstory on who you are and what you've been doing?
Yeah, so I've had sort of an interest in this field for the last 10 years or so. I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Bath in sport and exercise science. So I very much wanted to sort of work with elite athletes, you know, making Usain Bolt run, you know, half a second faster, and helping a weightlifter to lift an extra 10 kilos or whatever else it might be. And while I was doing that undergraduate degree, sort of hearing the passionate way that the lecturer spoke about health improvement and things like that, I ended up swinging more towards the health side of things. And I did my undergraduate dissertation on intermittent fasting. It was quite a small scale project. We only had around about 3 months to recruit everyone, get all the data collected, get all the samples analyzed and get it written up. So it was a fairly intense few weeks. But that was culminating all in 2012. And after that, I went on to work in private healthcare, sort of talking to people about diet and exercise and developing action plans for them to try and improve their health. And all of that was going on around the time that Michael Mosley came out with his Horizon documentary in 2012 on intermittent fasting, along with the book as well, Fast Diet, I think it was called. So there was a lot of public interest in the field of intermittent fasting. But actually there wasn't. So we had a lot of people sort of coming in to ask us, you know, is it safe? Does it work? Is it better than the alternatives? And the only answer I could really give in a lot of cases was we simply don't know, because the research wasn't really there to substantiate it. So when I decided to return and study for a PhD, there was really only one area I was interested in researching, and that was intermittent fasting. So I went back to the University of Bath, worked with now Professor James Betts, Dr. Javier Gonzalez, and Professor Dylan Thompson. And we put together this long-term, quite comprehensive study to explore some new dimensions of intermittent fasting. We finished that last year. And we're now just in the process of drawing up some publications and things like that as well. So, yeah, it's been a long old 10 years or so, but it's been bubbling away in the background, and intermittent fasting's always been the main theme, I'd say.
Nice. A lot of people then that maybe are not into health and fitness and wellbeing in as much detail as maybe what me and you are would have heard this term intermittent fasting and they might be a little bit confused about what it is. Obviously, fasting's been around for centuries, thousands of years. But this term intermittent fasting, can you just go into a little bit more detail about what that is, just for the people that maybe are a bit unsure about what it exactly is?
Yeah, absolutely. Intermittent fasting is an umbrella term that we use to describe quite a few different strategies that have sort of an overarching theme to them. And that's that we impose either a severe or, in some cases, complete energy restriction within specific time periods. So instead of controlling necessarily the quantity of food that people consume, we actually sort of concentrate their feeding behaviors into a certain time period. So that could be, for example, 6 hours in the morning, and that's a strategy that we would usually call time-restricted feeding, and that's applied every day. You've got the 5-2 diet, which is where you reduce your energy intake quite heavily on 2 days a week and eat normally on the other five. We've got modified alternate day fasting, which is fairly similar in terms of you apply quite a severe energy restriction on the fasting periods, but then they're applied on every other day and you eat normally on the intervening days. And then you've got complete alternate day fasting, which is probably the most extreme form, where you alternate between days of feeding and fasting, but on the fasting days, there's literally zero calories permitted. So it's most commonly unsweetened energy-free drinks. So black teas and coffees with no milk or sugar, water, both still and sparkling, some herbal teas and things like that.
Awesome.
So that's the sort of, those are the broad terms I use to describe those. I'm sure there are individuals who will have come across slightly different iterations of those, but those are the main four that we talk about when we talk about intermittent fasting. And it's all about that timing of intake.
Got you. Changed. When people then start to experiment with intermittent fasting or maybe want to implement it, what are some of the common problems, issues, maybe preconceptions that you come across with most people when they start this journey of intermittent fasting, or they maybe wanting to give it a go? What kind of problems do you see time and time again, or what things do you hear time and time again?
Quite a few different ones, so I'll do my best to keep this part short, but obviously we recruit quite widely for our studies. We like to recruit members of the public, and what we found is we can sometimes get really quite polarized responses from people, where you've got some people that absolutely love the idea and want to give it a go, and other people who think it's probably the worst thing you could ever ask them to do. So a lot of times the real challenge is overcoming those preconceptions about what's a healthy diet and what's not, because from a very young age, we're told that 3 meals a day is healthy and that's what we should be doing. And therefore any deviation from that must be unhealthy. We're told that snacking is bad, for example, and all these other things. So we have had some people get in contact to say they disagree with what we're doing insofar as they think we're promoting what they term a fad diet, which is ultimately what intermittent fasting started out as. And so those individuals, obviously, you know, you can understand their perspective. Obviously, maybe they've tried it and it hasn't worked for them, and they'd rather we invest our time in looking at other things. But for us, the whole idea was that a lot of people were doing these diets because of the popularity that came from everything that went on between 2012 and 2014. But there wasn't really that much data for us to actually provide any kind of evidence-based guidance to people on how these diets should best be applied. So that was the gap we sort of set out to fill, just providing more information to people. So I'd say that sort of preconception is probably one of the biggest challenges. People also have a lot of reservations about fasting because we did a complete alternate day approach. So it was 24-hour periods of no calorie intake, which isn't something most people will have come across. And as a result, there was a lot of trepidation about undertaking those periods of fasting. Am I going to feel faint? Am I going to feel dizzy? Am I going to be hangry? Is usually the word that's thrown around quite a lot, and concerns about that. And then alongside that as well, there's always concerns about how it's going to fit into your routine. And I'd say that's probably one of the main weaknesses to intermittent fasting, is that it's not necessarily as compatible with sort of the social lives that we lead, because most people do stick to 3 meals a day. So if you want to go out for dinner with friends and you're in the middle of a fasting period, then you don't really want to sit there and have a glass of sparkling water or something. You'd much rather join in and engage with that social event. So I'd say those are the main areas that we have to grapple with in this field.
Got you. How do these individuals then start to get over these problems and start to implement it? I mean, the guys that you've worked with and done the studies on, but also just the general public, how would they start to get over these obstacles or get over these preconceived ideas and start to implement various forms or one form of intermittent fasting?
Yeah, well, with our participants, the one thing I'd always recommend is when someone did have reservations about fasting for that length of time, my best advice then would just be give it a go, but sort of build it up gradually. So start off, say, for example, skipping your breakfast. So you go overnight and up to midday, maybe without any food intake, see how you feel there. And then just keep on sort of extending that duration until you've got that full 24-hour period, or whatever period it might be that you're doing. In much the same way with exercise, you don't go straight into the gym and you don't start lifting the heaviest weights and trying to run 10 kilometers as fast as the treadmill will take you. You go in and you build it up gradually and you find your feet with it a little bit. And in most instances, what we find is people are actually surprised by how straightforward fasting is. And that comes back to the point you alluded to earlier on, where the human body's actually evolved around this need to fast, sometimes for quite long periods. So we can actually cope with it fairly well. The tricky part usually is in those first few days where people are sort of acclimatizing to it and this revised feeding schedule. But once your body starts to get a grip for what's going on, a few things get shunted around and ultimately we can accommodate it much more effectively. So I think that's why that sort of slightly more graded introduction, where you just try a few days, maybe slightly shorter durations to begin with to get a feel for how it might go, is often the best strategy to make sure no one's put off it prematurely.
How would they select which protocol to follow then? Or is it just a case of what feels best for that individual, or trial and error? What's the best
to select? That's quite a long question, I imagine. But there's obviously these different forms, and the best form for you is probably going to be the one that you can stick with. So for some people, going for 24 hours uninterrupted fasting doesn't work particularly well with their routine. So I'd say that's quite a difficult one to implement. The only reason we chose to study that one in the research that we did was because that was where we thought we stood the best chance of establishing what the benefits of this particular diet actually were. The other thing to keep in mind is, as you're going for that longer period of fasting, you can also start to lose a little bit of lean mass or muscle mass as well. So sometimes that prolonged 24-hour period, particularly in older adults, can actually be a little bit detrimental. So I'd usually encourage people to shy away from that extreme. The modified intermittent fasting and the 5-2 diet are generally quite similar. 5-2 diet has a little bit more flexibility in social terms, which I think is why it's been so popular, because instead of just having to fast on every other day, which is, you know, quite enforced, for example, if you know you're going out for dinner on Saturday, you're probably not going to put a fast day on your Saturday. So you can much more effectively marry it up with what else is going on in your life. The one personally I'm the biggest fan of, and I think certainly the research in the area seems to be pointing towards, is time-restricted feeding.
I knew he was going to say that.
And that's where, yeah, that's where you sort of narrow that feeding window every day. And that has a few benefits. Obviously, you're allowed some food intake every day, which is an advantage over those complete alternate day forms. But also, for example, if you're restricting it down to, say, 8 hours a day, you're still getting a 16-hour fasting interval, but you're applying that every day. So it's a little bit more consistent, and therefore it's more opportunities for your body to clear through, for example, any surplus lipids you might have floating around in your system that can lead to things like type 2 diabetes and heart disease. And the other added benefit is, because that fast can be applied consistently sort of day to day, what we will often find is that it actually works better with our body clocks, so our circadian rhythms, which are always trying to anticipate what's coming next so they can handle it as effectively as possible. So having that consistency also caters to that side a little bit more effectively. And although the research is sort of in its infancy at the moment, so I think you'll see a bit more coming out over the next few years, it seems to be associated with, generally speaking, very positive effects, certainly comparable to what you would get from your more conventional approaches to dieting. Even if you're not actively restricting calories, having that sort of shorter feeding window does tend to reduce energy intake naturally. So you might not necessarily need to calorie count, which would be a huge burden lifted for an awful lot of people.
Yeah.
And there's a few animal studies coming through, and we always need to be careful with animal studies of diet because the feeding behavior animals is always very different to our own, but they seem to suggest that, for example, we could follow a time-restricted feeding protocol throughout the week, not follow it at the weekend, so you have that little bit more social flexibility, and then come back to it in the week, and you still get the majority of those benefits. So
it kind of combines
that flexibility. But as I said, that's mostly coming from animal models at the moment because the research is still relatively young, and there haven't been that many human trials. But the ones that are there certainly seems to be some promise. But for example, if you're narrowing your feeding window to, let's say, the morning, where we argue it might be the most effective, it then means, socially speaking, it's not as flexible in the evening. So there's still a few barriers to overcome. It's by no means perfect, but it seems to sort of overcome a lot of the limitations whilst retaining a lot of the benefits of intermittent fasting in its various forms.
Yeah, we're going to come on to the benefits and some of the research and some of your findings in a few minutes, but I just wanted to touch on that time-restricted eating. What is the optimal or the best kind of time frame? Is it 8 hours? Is it 6 hours? What works the best?
The ranges that have been used have generally gone from around about 4 hours in some of the more extreme studies of it, where people have been asked to apply that over 8 weeks. But that's usually quite carefully controlled, so all the food is provided for them to sort of help make sure that they consume the number of calories they need to be consuming within that time frame. So I wouldn't encourage anything anywhere near that extreme. I'd say 8 hours is probably the optimal, but 10 hours is still going to be an improvement over conventional meal patterns.
Yeah.
But there isn't really research to say that one duration is better than the other at this particular stage. Those comparative studies will probably come a little bit further down the line once we understand what the effects are and exactly what it is that we need to look at. But I'd say as long as you're sort of getting it down towards a 10-hour feeding opportunity, that's probably far enough removed from what most people are doing normally to exert some kind of effect. But I wouldn't encourage people to go certainly below 6 hours just because it becomes quite impractical and very difficult to do. I'd say usually about 8 to 10 would probably be optimal.
Perfect. From my experience personally, I mean, I've not done any studies, but I've dabbled with intermittent fasting myself and used it with clients as well, and I'm on the same wavelength of you. I've found that the time restricted eating seems to work the best with people, and it's the one that they can fit into their lives the best as well. And as you say, most people I've seen use it, and I've tried it myself as well, that kind of 8 hour window seems to be about right and tend to get really good results with that as well. So that's interesting to hear you say that as well. Right, let's move on to the good stuff, the nitty-gritty of the science and the research. Let's just talk about the study that you've been, or the studies you've been doing. I know you've been hectically busy over the last 6 months, because for the listeners, we touched base back in the summer of last year and it took us this long to get on a call together. So I want to talk about some of the findings, the studies, the research. What is the current research showing and saying in terms of health benefits, how it affects the human body, etc.?
Yeah, so there's really two main themes that are coming through in the findings. So really, when we're looking at trying to understand what its effects are, what we're looking to do is to compare it against the current standard, which is just your conventional calorie restriction. So straight away, we're looking for those studies that are drawing that comparison between an intermittent fasting approach, whether that's the 5-2 diet, whether that's modified alternate day fasting, time-restricted feeding, complete alternate day fasting, and these daily calorie restriction approaches. Now, with the 5-2 diet and the modified alternate day fasting, those comparisons generally suggest it produces similar benefits to daily calorie restriction. Similar weight losses, generally you see improvements in sort of cholesterol profile, so the lipids floating or fats floating around in your circulation. Also improvements in glycemic control, so reductions in fasting glucose levels, which is what they measure for type 2 diabetes. And better handling of sugars in response to meals and things like that is generally the theme that comes through from those types of studies. Where we start to see potentially some slightly added benefits of intermittent fasting is when we're getting slightly extended fasting periods. So for example, if you think about, let's say, modified alternate day fasting, where you have a day of normal eating, and then that's followed by a day where you will have 600 to 800 kilocalories usually, consumed as a single meal between, I think it's 12 and 2 in the afternoon. So basically, a reasonably sized lunch is what you're permitted during that fasting period. And what that means is you fast overnight, you then sort of get an extra 4 hours added onto that fast in the morning, which is taking up to around about 12 hours. You then eat this meal, which is probably going to elevate sort of the concentrations of fats and sugars in your bloodstream and things which your body has to metabolize and work through for around about 6 hours, in some cases slightly longer. So by the time you're getting back into that fasted state again, you've probably only got around about another 12 hours before you're then having breakfast the following morning. So you never really get an uninterrupted fast that's longer than 12 hours, maybe 14 at a stretch, depending on exactly the format that you use. And those are the sort of formats where we usually see that they produce very similar results to calorie restriction, because you're never really omitting more than one meal in sequence. But when we look at some of the 5-2 studies where they apply those sort of two fasting days consecutively, so you have 5 days of normal eating, 2 days of this really severe energy restriction, what you start to see is that they get some added benefits. So when you eat a mixed meal, for example, so like you would do normally with your dinner, you'll see that there'll be slightly fewer fats floating around in your bloodstream, so they're handling those lipid sort of influx slightly more effectively. They also see things like a reduction in C-peptide concentration, which is basically a marker that tells us we're secreting a little bit less insulin, potentially. So changes in the way our body's secreting insulin. And those changes are generally consistent with benefits over these more continuous alternatives. And that's because when you apply that fast on consecutive days, yes, you do that usual part where you fast overnight, you then skip breakfast and say, have your lunchtime meal. That elevates your sugar and your fats again, as we discussed before, for a few hours. And then it comes back down to normal, and then you fast overnight once again, so you get that same 12-hour period. But then you're going straight into another fast. So straight away, you add another maybe 4, 5, 6 hours onto the other side of that. So instead of not having a fast that goes any longer than 12 hours, you're suddenly getting up towards around about 18 hours of fasting, maybe even 20 at a push. And it seems to be that when we're getting that slightly longer uninterrupted fast, as opposed to the overall amount of fasted time that we put in place, that's where some of these added benefits seem to come through. And they do seem to be in terms of how well our body handles sugar and how well our body handles fat. And that kind of carries through in a lot of instances to the studies where you do get those longer fasting durations. So for example, time-restricted feeding, where you're doing maybe either a 4 to an 8 hour window, we see there seems to be some benefits compared to daily calorie restriction in terms of body composition and things like that. And with the complete alternate day approach, where you're maybe getting 20 to 32 hours of uninterrupted fasting, we also start to see some improvements in things like insulin sensitivity as well. Those studies are quite varied in their design, so actually drawing any conclusions from those is quite difficult, but certainly from those few studies we've got where we are getting those longer uninterrupted fasting durations, it seems to be better for sort of our control in the postprandial period, so after we've eaten a meal, which can be very, very important for the risk of heart disease and diabetes.
Very, very interesting. So,
sorry, it went on for quite a while there.
No, that's great. It's brilliant, and it's explained really, really well as well in layman terms. And the biggest kind of takeaway I really took from that as well is that ultimately there's going to be long-term health benefits as well from this intermittent fasting, isn't there? Because if we're reducing the sugars, how our body processes fat and insulin, then ultimately stuff like coronary heart disease and these horrible kind of diseases that can affect us, particularly later in life, are, I'm guessing, going to be reduced a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to say absolutely categorically, because with these studies, the reason we look at these, for example, postprandial flux of nutrients and things like that, is because that is generally related to your risk of heart disease or diabetes, for example. So it's sort of a marker that we can use without, because obviously, ethically speaking, we can't feed someone a diet that's going to give them full-blown diabetes, because ethically, it's just a huge no. So we use these kind of markers. But what I should say at this stage is one area where the research is really lacking at the moment is those longer-term studies. So usually you're not getting, you're applying these studies over the course of, in some cases, as little as 2 weeks, up to around about 8 weeks at most. There are a few that have gone up to 6 months, maybe a year. Back in 2017, there was quite a big one, but they're fairly few and far between. So to say categorically that this will reduce your risk of diabetes and heart disease, the data isn't really there.
Yeah.
But certainly it improves some things that we suspect increase your risk of those conditions in the long term. So indirectly, yes, but direct evidence to support that, it's not quite there yet.
Got you. One of the biggest things I noticed, because I did the 24-hour fast, so 2 days a week doing a 24-hour fast, and I've also done the time-restricted eating. One of the biggest things I noticed is when I went into the gym to train, I was training like an absolute maniac, like I had so much energy and I felt stronger. Can you explain why that might have been, or give any insight into that? Because I know there's some other people that might have experienced this as well, but I was training so hard when I'm fasting.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting one actually, because a lot of people do expect to find that when they're fasting, if they've got no energy coming into the system, they're going to feel lethargic, they're going to feel sluggish. And very often we found that that isn't actually the case. As you've said, some people find they have more energy and they're more active. So there's an argument to say that perhaps that they're looking for a distraction from the fasting, because usually you'd be in the kitchen preparing food and maybe you're feeling a little bit hungry at certain times of the day. Maybe you sort of think, oh, I'll go out and do something as a result. So that's one argument that's been put forward. But in terms of your ability to exercise, what you've got to keep in mind is that fasting, generally speaking, gives you quite a sort of steady state. So for example, if I were to have a meal, say an hour before I went and did some training, I'd get a big spike in my blood sugar levels, obviously assuming it was quite a high sugar meal, and in sort of the triglycerides as well. My body would produce insulin to try and bring that sugar level back under control and bring it back within normal limits. But then because I start doing exercise before that's actually happened, essentially my body starts extracting sugar from the bloodstream at a faster rate as well. And you can actually slightly overshoot. And that's what we call rebound hypoglycemia. And that's often when people will feel really sluggish. So with fasting, you've got a reservoir of glucose that your body can slowly release, which is found in the liver. So once actually you've gone for a certain number of hours fasting, your body just steadily releases that glucose to meet energy demands. And obviously, assuming the exercise isn't too long duration to the point where that sort of little backup reserve would start to be depleted, generally we can actually exercise pretty effectively for quite a few hours. In terms of precisely, for example, why you might be able to lift more or sort of hit your PBs in that line of things, because we know if we drink some sugar during exercise, usually we'll be able to run a little bit further, for example. So precisely why that might be, I mean, it'd be wild speculation at this stage, so there's no real research to say that that's the case. But there is a research group over in the States, and I've met with them quite frequently at conferences and things like that. Because we research in similar areas, they focus more on time-restricted feeding now. So that 16-8 ratio of feeding to fasting every day. And they've combined that with some resistance training to look at whether it hampers your ability to get strength gains and things like that. And it really seems that that isn't the case, which is, it seems, a common misconception about things like intermittent fasting, is they don't hamper our ability to exercise and train in the way we might have expected.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said as well for the whole ancestral thing as well, isn't there? That we probably would have not eaten for a while and then gone and lifted a load of heavy stuff or tried to take down a big animal. So it's almost in our genetics DNA, so to speak.
Yeah, and there's another interesting dimension to this as well, because another area of my research that I've gotten into during my PhD in particular is your circadian rhythms, which I mentioned earlier on. So yeah, your body clocks. It's the reason why, having spent all week getting up at 5 a.m, say, when you don't have to get up early on a Saturday morning, chances are you're still going to wake up at around about 5 o'clock. That's all your body basically trying to anticipate what's going on to make you do things at certain times of day, which is why we'll get hungry around our usual meal times. But even if we don't eat, that hunger tends to drop away. That's all to do with these circadian rhythms. And we believe that the reason we have those rhythms is because as you go through sort of day and night, because we weren't really well adapted to doing anything at night, a lot of the challenges to our body were during the day. So we were more active during the day. We had energy flowing into our system during the day. And therefore, we evolved these rhythms that would allow us to anticipate when those challenges were going to happen to make sure we could respond accordingly. And what recent research has shown is that actually the time at which we have nutrients entering our system helps to regulate a lot of those rhythms. So the time at which you eat often can influence things like muscle function. It can influence sort of the sensitivity of your tissues to that hormone insulin. So it affects how responsive your body is and how capable it is of handling that influx of glucose. So that's another really interesting dimension. And for example, we know that there are circadian rhythms in muscle strength. So generally speaking, it seems that people seem to be at their strongest between 4 and 8 in the evening, is I think the number. I'm going slightly from memory here. So it may well be that you've got these changes in meal timing influencing muscle function in that way by resetting these clocks in our peripheral tissue, so your muscle, your adipose, your liver. And that's another whole area that's sort of coming to the fore, and they're kind of appearing at the same time. So I think there's going to be some really exciting research in this field over the next few years.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. That sounds as well like it's a whole other podcast of circadian.
Yeah, I think we could probably do a whole other one on that one.
No, but that stuff fascinates me as well, because I'm really interested in the whole sleep cycles and the circadian rhythms as well, and how that affects your health and your well-being and underpins a lot of things. So that's really interesting to hear that as well. Okay, let's move on a little bit. And one thing, I know there's not a lot of research behind this, but you did mention earlier in the podcast that the longer periods of time people fast for, you start to see some more benefits and more interesting things. Where does it become borderline dangerous? Because now what's coming up a lot is, in inverted commas, you're getting your biohackers and stuff like that doing 7-day fast, 5-day fast, 14-day fast. So where does it become like that's a bit crazy, or is there any benefits to doing longer fasts, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it's an interesting area. You do have people where you get instances where people say, oh, I did a 5-day fast and that cured this medical condition that I seem to have. And I don't doubt potentially fasting of longer duration does work in those isolated cases, but there's no real scientific data to say this is what fasting of this duration does that causes this to happen. So it could just be a huge placebo effect in those cases. And it could be a whole bunch of other factors as well that were going alongside it. You never hear what medications they were taking at the same time. Maybe this happened to coincide with a change in their medication or something like that could also explain it. So you always want to be wary of, you know, the classic story of my friend did this and this happened. Because the reason we sort of recruit so many participants in research is to rule out those kinds of things. So that's why we do these research studies, is to provide those slightly more concrete answers, or try to anyway. It doesn't always work out that way, unfortunately. Certainly, I've never seen any research that sort of advocates the health benefits of fasting for longer than sort of 24, maybe at stretch 36 hours. And that's sort of within these intermittent fasting contexts, because the problem is when you're applying a fast, a 24-hour fast, for example, you then get the question of, well, hang on, how frequently are you going to apply this? And when you start going beyond that 24-hour cutoff, and sometimes even before it, actually, you start to see losses of lean mass, of muscle mass, which I imagine will be of interest to some of your listeners. And you also start to see sort of changes in, you know, the neuronal networks and things like that with fasting. You see changes in cognitive performance. So even your ability to make decisions sometimes can be impaired. There are a few studies that say potentially it could be improved, but most of the studies that go beyond 24 to 36 hours of fasting are looking at it purely from understanding how human physiology copes, and they're not necessarily looking for health benefits in most instances. So for me, I think once you start going beyond 20, 24 hours for certain, you start to introduce potentially more risks than benefits. So for me, I'd never advocate anything for someone longer than that duration. I have had a few people come to me and say, oh, I'm really interested in the field. I've done a few 72-hour fasts and I do absolutely fine. So the body, as I said, is geared to deal with that duration of fast if it needs to. But precisely the benefits of that, I don't know. And the risks obviously start to amplify the further into that fasting period you go. So yeah, I'd definitely keep it less than 24 hours. And I think that's where the time-restricted feeding approach works quite well.
Yeah. Don't go and start doing any seven-day fasts, listeners. Start with your short before you do that. I have got a client that did a seven-day water fast. I've got a client that did it. And I saw him after... I didn't train him during this time, obviously. But I saw him after about 4 days. And he literally looked like he had no life in him at all. And he said, after,
I can imagine.
Yeah, he said after kind of 3 or 4 days, then exactly what you mentioned at the start of your little piece there was the cognitive function. He said he lost that ability to kind of make sensible or informed decisions. So he just kind of like just locked himself in his house and just carried on with it. So,
well, yeah, I certainly wouldn't feel comfortable driving or anything like that or operating heavy machinery.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm
on the same wavelength of you, as I agree that. Probably when it gets beyond that 24, 48-hour period, the risks outweigh the benefits. So yeah, let's stick to the time restricted eating or the 24-hour periods.
Also, definitely a case of walk before you can run.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's just start to wrap things up then, Ian. I know obviously you've been very busy. We've both got busy days. So I just want to wrap things up and just touch on a few little points before we finish things. The first thing I want to ask you is, there'll be a lot of people that have listened to this and think, right, I've never done intermittent fasting before, or maybe I've had a little bit of a play with it and I want to take it on board now. I want to really give it a go and maybe implement it into their everyday life, or just maybe give it a go for a few weeks. Can you just give my listeners, the listeners, 2 or 3 tips that they can put into practice pretty much as soon as this podcast is finished, so they can start to incorporate intermittent fasting into their daily routine?
Yeah, absolutely. I always like to start by framing these conversations by saying I've got my PhD, so I'm not a medically trained professional. So obviously any decisions will need to be based on sort of the best advice that your GP gives you. Because, for example, certain medications and certain psychological disorders, for example, we don't know how intermittent fasting might impact on those. We generally study fairly healthy people. Occasionally studies are done in people with type 2 diabetes and things like that, but we don't really know much about that huge swathe of other people. So always check with your GP if you've got any concerns and get their input on it to just be on the safe side. The first recommendation probably comes back to what we were talking to earlier. So try building it in gradually. Don't try and go straight for a 24-hour fast. Have a go with, you know, omitting a certain meal. Dinner is usually quite an effective one because you get, you know, a nice bit of intake beforehand, and then sort of it's just going up to that spell before bed, and then you can sort of resume eating again in the morning. So build it in gradually. Second of all, I would say when you do get into those slightly longer fasting durations, so when you are getting up to maybe 14 to 16 hours, for example, per day, don't get discouraged if you find it a little bit tricky. The first few days, consistently, our participants always report to be the worst. But then once they've done 2, maybe 3 of those fasting spells, and bear in mind, this is 24 hours of fasting as well, so slightly more extreme in our study. they find that their bodies start to acclimatize to the revised schedule. So if you can do the first 2 or 3 days, you won't have any problems sort of going forward. And last of all, do be mindful of taking it too fast. So as we've said, shy away of those particularly long, certainly consecutive days of complete fasting. And do still be mindful of the type of foods that you're eating. So still try and get, you know, your 5 a day in particular. Do try and make sure you're getting a reasonable amount of protein, because if we drop protein too far, chances are you'll start to reduce a little bit of lean mass as well. Make sure you're getting a good amount of fiber. Make sure you're staying hydrated during those fasted periods as well. All of those rules still apply. Intermittent fasting isn't sort of a magic bullet that's going to fix everything. So it should be integrated as part of a rounded and sort of healthy lifestyle, if you will.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I'm going to reiterate the point that you made and highlight that bit you said about on the days that you are eating to still eat well, because I think a lot of people think, oh, I'm going to do a 2-day fast or I'm going to do a time restricted eating fast, and then I can just go and eat whatever I want and just cram in the ice cream and the pizza and all that kind of stuff. And that's not really the idea of it, is it? That's not how your body's going
to
adjust.
Not quite, no. It's more about providing opportunities for your body to sort of clear any surplus sort of nutrients and things that might be deposited in places where they're not, and sort of give your body a sort of more natural rhythm in terms of feeding and fasting periods. It's sort of the strongest rationale. So yeah, don't think it gets you out of having to do all the other bits.
Awesome. One final question. Do you fast?
Funnily enough, I get asked this one a lot, and people are often surprised to find that I don't actually fast. I absolutely love my food. We do have a rule of thumb where before we ask any participants to do any intervention, we do it ourselves, mostly to check that it can be done. And so when you're talking people through the study, you can let them know, you know, roughly speaking, what they might expect, some of the challenges they might face in terms of the social side of things. So I've tried it from that point of view, but on a regular basis, personally, I don't. But I think if, for example, I had, you know, if I was looking for weight loss, or if I was looking for sort of a resolution of some kind of metabolic disorder, I'd probably consider it a little bit more carefully.
Very interesting. Do as I say.
Usually people expect the reason I fast is, or the reason I research it is because I want it to work and I want everyone to believe that it's the best thing for you. And I think it can be really useful, but just for the things I'm interested in, it doesn't seem most appropriate approach for me at the moment.
Yeah, got you. Where can the listeners go then, Ian, to find out more about you and the work that you've done and are doing?
So there's a few different places. Obviously, we're looking to put out publications in the next few months on the research specifically that we've done. So the best way to keep an eye out for those is to keep an eye on our Twitter feeds. So it's just at Ian Templeman. I'm not sure if we can drop this in a comment section or something like that somewhere. Yeah, but so Twitter is a great place. Also following my supervisors, James Bett. So we'll see if we can get those Twitter tags up as well. Also, a lot of our research is based at the University of Bath. And usually when we put out one of those publications, there'll be a story about it on the university webpage as well. I should say there's some other really good research groups looking at this stuff all around the world. So you've got a research group over at the University of Surrey who has recently actually done some really cool stuff with time-restricted feeding. So I'd recommend keeping an eye on their pages as well. Dr. Rona Anthony is doing some cracking work over there and some really well-controlled studies as well. So I'd recommend looking those up. Over in the States, you've got a research group with Krista Varady, and they do a lot of the modified alternate day fasting, a lot of 5-2 work as well. So certainly worth having a look at their stuff as well. But I'd say Twitter is actually probably one of the best ways to keep up what's going on in the research, because whenever we get a paper out, whenever we've got an interesting finding, and sometimes even squeezing out a little bit of data before it goes to the journals and things like that, we'll drop a figure or something like that on our presentation. So do keep an eye out on the Twitter feed. It's probably the best recommendation.
Awesome. And your publications, they're coming out very soon, right? The work you've been doing over the last...
Hopefully so, yeah. So because of the fairly hectic schedule that rounded out my PhD, we've got it all written up into a thesis, which I had to submit for my exam. And now we're in the process of translating that thesis into papers that we can submit to journals. So certainly in the next few months, and the job for the rest of today is to complete a review that we're writing at the moment. on intermittent fasting, the rationales for it, and what the research currently shows. So hopefully that one will be out certainly within the next 3 months, and we'll kind of provide a summary of a lot of the stuff we've actually been talking about today.
Awesome. Keep your eyes peeled for that then, guys. That's wicked. Thank you so much, Ian, for your time. I really appreciate it.
No problem at all. Thanks for the invite.
That's great. We always end my podcast with a favorite quote. And I think I mentioned this in the email, or I might have put you back on the spot, but can you finish this episode and leave us with a favorite quote?
Ooh, that is, I actually wrapped up my thesis with a really cheesy quote after all these long sort of intellectual discussions about intermittent fasting, the effects that it might have. And ultimately the conclusion was, is that intermittent fasting does have a lot of potential to help us improve our health, particularly in metabolic terms. After all, it is often said that time heals all wounds. So I'd probably close on that one.
I love it. That's great. Cheers, mate. Appreciate your time. Good luck with all of your work and your review that you're going to be working hard on today. And I wish you all the success.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, mate.
Appreciate that. Have a good day, Ali. And thanks again for the invite. Hope it's been good.
There we have it, listeners. That's a wrap on episode number 36 of the Kinetic Fitness Show. Thank you so much to Ian for sharing his knowledge and wisdom and expertise around the area of intermittent fasting with us today. Brilliant information that he shared there, and I hope you guys took on board some of that info and are gonna at least attempt to try some intermittent fasting and introduce it into your everyday routine. Or if you already fast, then hopefully you've gained some more knowledge and some more information on how beneficial intermittent fasting can be for your health. That's it for this week. I thank you so much for listening. I always appreciate you guys listening in. Don't forget to tell your friends about this podcast. Share it with them. Also, don't forget to like, follow, subscribe, and leave a review. And follow me on Instagram. All the descriptions, the handles, the website, they're all in the description of this podcast. So don't forget to click on that and have a read. And I will speak to you all again next week. Until then, have a great week. Stay strong, stay healthy, and have a blessed week. Peace and love.